The holidays are all about sharing with family. Meals, couches, stories, grandma's secret pecan pie recipe. And now, you can also share a cart with Instacart's family carts. Everyone can add what they want to one group cart from wherever they are. So you don't have to go from room to room to find out who wants cranberry sauce, or who should get mini marshmallows for the yams, or collecting votes for sugar cookies versus shortbread. Just share a cart and then share the meals and the moments. Download the Instacart app and get delivery in as fast as 30 minutes. Plus, enjoy free delivery on your first three orders. Service fees and terms apply.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
I'm Jenna Fisher.
And I'm Angela Kinsey.
And together we have the podcast Office Ladies.
Just because we finished rewatching The Office does not mean we're going anywhere.
Every Wednesday, we'll be sharing even more exclusive stories from The Office and our friendship with brand new guests. Plus, you can revisit all the Office Ladies rewatch episodes every Monday with new bonus tidbits before every episode.
So follow and listen to Office Ladies on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back, folks. We have talked to Dr. Gregory Stewart several times. He's the medical director for the Tulane University Center for Brain Health, and he joins us, as well as Beryl Billiott, U.S. Marine Corps veteran and Westwego native, who endured years of pain from his 5 years of service, 1985 through 1991, and a life-changing brain tumor diagnosis, before working with Tulane and what that actually means. So, gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having
us. Great to be here.
Appreciate it.
And, Beryl, to you, thank you so much for your service on Veterans Day. It's very appropriate that we're talking about this today. Let me just pivot real quick to Dr. Stewart. There's been a lot of discussion around this country of our failure to address any number of group of citizens or folks, and the least of which would be the veterans, right? I mean, it's something that they make these sacrifices, and we just, for some reason or another, haven't been able to figure out how to best provide care for them. So tell us about this particular case with Mr. Billiott, and from your perspective, where we need to be and where we're failing.
Well, I appreciate you. Go ahead, Beryl.
No, well, Newell, the question was that directed at Dr. Stewart or myself?
To Dr. Stewart first, Beryl. I apologize.
Okay,
thank you.
Gotcha. No problem.
I think that we do a fairly decent job with a lot of things in caring for our veterans. One of the things that I think we, all of the medical folks, were slow to understand and address were those invisible wounds from the war on terror, you know, primarily traumatic brain injury, but post-traumatic stress, depression, anxiety. And it is a very, it's difficult because it's, you know, it's not like, you know, an amputation or something like that that's fairly standard in how you treat it. Each brain injury is different, and each person, you know, whatever they bring with them from a brain standpoint, it has to be taken into consideration as well. So it's a very, very individualized process approach for these veterans. And that's part of what we do with our program is that, you know, we've got a lot of disciplines, both physicians as well as, you know, speech pathologists, physical therapists, behavioral health providers, integrative therapists, audiology, balance, a whole bunch of folks that you have to bring together in order to really understand what is going on and how do you appropriately treat these individuals. And Beryl is one of those that had some, you know, number of these issues that that we went through this process, both a three-day process followed by a three-week intensive outpatient program to in order to help him.
So, Beryl, if you don't mind, tell us about your journey.
Well, it's, you know, one of the things that, and just recapping what Dr. Stewart kind of mentioned, that the individuality of the individual. Now, the first thing that has to happen, and this is something that I've realized through the program, is that the individual has to be willing to accept the situation and to also participate, because, you know, we as veterans, and especially myself, as, you know, I was trained to suffer in silence. You know, you don't complain, you suck it up and move on, and you fight the battle and you proceed with the mission, and you don't let things get in the way. And as we have, you know, progressed through our training and we do different things, we're put in this mindset to carry the nation's mission forward. And it's critical to do that. But the problem that we have is, you know, I was injured during service and I was medically discharged. And that in itself was pretty traumatic because I wanted to be a career Marine. That was my intent. But, you know, plans change, right? So in the process, on the way out, you were never deprogrammed from the way that you were trained. You just go back into the civilian world with the same ideology, with the same mentality that you have to just push on, you have to press, you have to complete the mission at all case. And then so that doesn't fit very well in the civilian world. So that creates a lot of mental and emotional stress that you're not trained to deal with on a regular basis. And what I have found is I have friends that I served with, friends in the community that also suffered some of the stress and ended up taking their own life because they were unable to handle the pain or the stress that they were dealing with because there was never an outlet. In the military, you have a brotherhood of people to lean on, people that understand what you've gone through. In the civilian world, that's not the case. Even when you're being treated through the VA, they treat symptoms and not the problem. You know, if you're hurting, they give you pain medication. They don't find out really what the problem is. I mean, it took 20-something years to diagnose me with a brain tumor. That was some of the issue that I had. So, you know, there's my journey started, you know, when I got out, the emotional problems, and as things progressed, I started having more and more issues psychologically, personality changes. You know, as of course, that when finding out later that I had a brain tumor was part of the problem with the things that I was having. As it was growing, it was creating a lot of these issues, but it was never found until September of 2023. And it probably was in there for about 15, 20 years. And and so all the struggle, the emotional, you know, just the trauma that you go through, the things. And I was not a combat veteran, right? So I was fortunate. I did support Desert Shield, Desert Storm, but I never saw combat. And to know the trauma that I would experience, I cannot only imagine, you know, what some of my friends and you know, fellow Marines and a lot of other soldiers had faced, you know, doing that. And we all have a mission to accomplish, and we all have to go, and we all go through the training. But, you know, we're never debriefed on the way out. And when you look through history and you look at, you know, even in biblical times when, you know, armies would go off to war, they had this whole process that they would go through preparing as they get there. They had months of travel to get to the battlefield. Then when they got done, they had months of travel back home, and they went through these ritual and cleansing processes to get back to socialize back into their, you know, civilian environment. We don't do that. We take people, we go in, we train hard, we move, turn them into machines to do the job that nobody else wants to do. And then when your time is over, we turn you loose and say, okay, figure it out. And so you know, that stress and pressure is what we really, I think, what we really need to look at and how we treat this emotional and mental trauma, because that was more of what I had. Pain is easy to deal with, but it's the suffering and that comes along with that, that is really the debilitating aspect. You know, we can all have a high pain tolerance, but when it's a mental thing tied to it that just makes you believe that you cannot continue because you are less than the man you used to be, you are less than the person I was, you know, pushed out because I was insufficient to carry on my duties. Those mental things were really weighing me down more so than the physical aspects. And again, with the personality changes and all the thing that I was seeing and the anger and all that, once I was introduced to Tulane and I went for the 3-day and found to be a candidate for the program, the 3-week process was truly life-changing for me. The information that was given about that's one of the problems I have is I get stuck for words sometimes, but when you're going through the process with the mental part of it, because they don't only look at what the symptom is, they try to find the whole root cause of what the problem is. And the reason that I was suffering so much had nothing to do with the physical ailment, but the mental and the psychological problems that I was holding back, that I was never able to let go and truly live. And so by having the team and the information that they provided about the physical things as well as handling the mental aspect as a whole, it truly gave me my life back. Rather than just fighting every day, I get up in the morning, even though I may creak and crack like everybody else our age, we can still smile and move on because we have something positive to look forward to instead of, oh God, another drudge day of getting through this, you know? So it's been a true blessing for me to be introduced to the program. But again, you have to acknowledge and you have to admit. And then a lot of the veterans that I know that are not getting treated, it's because they don't want to acknowledge that they have a problem. And so how do we fix that? You know, that's the thing, is how do we offer the support for one another to let them know that, hey, there is a program out there, or there are programs available that can help you get through this entire process, not just the pain, but the mental and the emotional stress that we struggle with each and every day. So that's where I am, and I'll be forever grateful for the opportunity. I have lifelong friends that I've made. And I can't see one of the people from the program without just feeling all happy. And, you know, I want to give them a big hug. And I normally do, whether they want it or not. But
Beryl, let me ask this question. So you got out in 91, and you talk about suffering in silence and really not recognizing the whole picture for you until September of 2023. It's a long time. This is a conversation that has been had over and over and over again in the circles of medicine, especially as it relates to veterans, right, and moving into the civilian workforce. Where are we missing connecting the dots? I mean, I'm sitting here and I'm just totally blown away that after having served our country for 6 years, that, you know, you're facing this issue until September of 2023. I mean, that's not acceptable in my view. Somebody's missing it somewhere. And I'm just kind of curious as to your thoughts.
My thoughts is, you know, the deprogramming or the debriefing aspect, when I know when I was separated, I went through a physical and they did, you know, physical checks, but they don't go through an in-depth process, right? And especially just coming out of training, that is still so fresh in your mind. You're still conditioned to suffer in silence, right? You're not going to just say, hey, look, I'm really hurting. I'm having all these issues. It's like, you know, then you're kind of admitting weakness, which is not what you do when you're trained to fight and move towards the battle.
Right.
And so I think there needs to be some type of comprehensive program that, as veterans, especially knowing if they're, you know, medically discharged or been through combat or have these traumatic experiences, that there is some type of step down program that, that we have to go through upon discharge. I would think that, you know, I have to admit, the VA did some great things for me over the years. They have.
Yeah, and this and is not meant to criticize the VA. I get it. I mean, they do phenomenal work.
Yes.
But it's just, I hear so many stories about vets that kind of fall through the cracks, you know, and it, you just kind of wonder.
And again, I think it all goes back to the admittance part of it. It took me a long time to admit that I have a problem. And, you know, it's before it was just like, I'm just going to fight through this. I can't let go. I have to keep pushing. I have to keep fighting. I'm a Marine, by God. I can't be weak, you know. And that's the mentality that we're trained to have, and that we face the issues, we overcome, we adapt. And so that's what I had done for so many years, just masking the true problem that I had. And until, you know, the medical diagnosis and then just the treatment from all aspects to get to the root cause, you know, that's what really changed my direction, is that it wasn't just treating the symptom of my problem. It was actually trying to find, the problem, right? It's just like if you got a car and you got rust on it and you just sand it and put paint on it, it's going to rust again. Until you get the rust out and fix it, it's never going to go away. It's going to keep
Carol, you're not alone. You're not alone on the text line. Someone texts in and says, I did 14 years and it took me 20 years plus to receive any help. The Marine you're talking to, he has a point. To Dr. Stewart, I'm sure you hear these stories quite frequently.
Absolutely. And I think there are a couple of points on this. One is that, you know, we obviously do a great job of training these individuals to be warriors. We just don't do a very good job of untraining them when they leave. And I think that's one. The other is these guys and girls have you know, they volunteered for the most part, the ones that the post 9/11 for sure, you know, they volunteered to go and do this. And they all come out, and 201 come out and are like, no, someone else needs this more than I do. You know, I don't want to take someone else's spot. And we really have to spend a decent amount of time talking to them about the fact that, you know, they want to help other people. This was God, country, family, why they went into it. And so they want to continue along with that, and they still have a mission. They still want to help others, and we have to sit and spend some time and effort talking to them about how much better they would be able to help others, how much better they could serve their own mission if we went through some of this treatment process. And once you kind of put it in those terms, then for the most part, they're willing to come back and sit down and say, you know what, you're right. I can help other people better, just like I had to train to be a warrior. I need to train to get better, and that's part of the process. So that's how we have to have that conversation with our veterans.
Absolutely. I have just a minute left. Beryl, obviously for all those years that you talk about suffering in silence, how dark was the dark?
Overwhelming. Had it not been for my spiritual faith, I think my journey would have been a whole lot worse. I had a supportive family. I've had my Lord and Savior with me, you know, and that's what carried me through when nothing else was there. And had I not, and the people that don't have the family or don't have their faith or not strong in their faith, they give up. And that's why the suicide rate is so high. And you know, because a lot of people come home to nothing. And I was fortunate to have a family that cared and was there. And I had good days, and I had some light in my darkness. But on the darkest day, I could have easily given up. And but somebody slapped me upside the head and said, "Hey, you can't quit. You know, it's time to go." And so, but it was very difficult in times. Different things that have happened. It made you question. You know, is it all worth it? And but it's always worth it to fight for the freedom and the security of the people and our country that we love. And, you know, one of the things that a lot of veterans today are facing is sometimes the country that we vowed to serve isn't the country we're living in today. But hopefully, you know, we can, and we want to fight to have that future that we had fought for, and to hope that things can continue on, and American prosperity and our freedoms and liberties can continue on. Because, you know, when I told my mother, I was a senior in high school when I enlisted in the United States Marine Corps. And I went home and I told my mom, I want to join the Marine Corps. And she said, "Why?" And I said, "If I don't, who will?" And that's the mentality of a lot of the veterans. We want to protect the life. And it is a service above self. And it's something that continues out. And Dr. Stewart made a great point. But if we're not healthy and able, then how can we fight for others when we can't even stand on our own two feet stably? And so I just want all the veterans out there that know that, you know, that are fighting this battle, that you're not alone, and that there are other veterans that are willing to stand. And I would love to talk to those who are in that dark place and say there is light at the end of the tunnel, and we just have to choose to keep moving towards it. And look for programs like this one at Tulane that really, truly changed my life and gave me my life back.
Well, Beryl, I can tell you that from my perspective. Go ahead, Doc.
I was just going to say real quick, because I know that we're close on time, and I think that, you know, Beryl made a point that one of the things on veteran suicide, that mild traumatic brain injury is an independent risk factor for veteran suicide, which is why we focus on the mild brain injury here at Tulane.
Because it changes your personality. It changes your perspective. Yes.
Got another text here. Two divorces, 20 years of darkness, and reaching rock bottom. Finally reached out and took help. 23 years in the Marines. Semper Fi. Beryl, in so many different ways, you're still a warrior, and you're very brave to share your story with us. And thankfully, you ultimately received the help that you needed so that you no longer suffer in silence. And there's so much more that we can do for vets, and that we should do, because so many have made the ultimate sacrifice and continue to make sacrifices each and every day. And we truly appreciate you sharing this with us today. And Dr. Stewart, thank you for the great work that you do as well.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much. Yes.
Thank you, sir. That's Beryl Billiott, U.S. Marine Corps veteran, Oswego native, and Dr. Gregory Stewart, medical director for the Tulane University Center for Brain Health. We'll be right back.
Why get all your holiday decorations delivered through Instacart? Because maybe you only bought two wreaths, but you have 12 windows. Or maybe your toddler got very eager with the advent calendar. Or maybe the inflatable snowman didn't make it through the snowstorm. Or maybe the twinkle lights aren't twinkling. Whatever the reason, this season, Instacart's here for hosts and their whole holiday haul. Get decorations from the Home Depot, CVS, and more through Instacart and enjoy free delivery on your first three orders. Service fees and terms apply.
I'm Jenna Fisher.
And I'm Angela Kinsey.
And together we have the podcast Office Ladies.
Just because we finished rewatching The Office does not mean we're going anywhere.
Every Wednesday, we'll be sharing even more exclusive stories from The Office and our friendship with brand new guests. Plus, you can revisit all the Office Ladies rewatch episodes every Monday with new bonus tidbits before every episode.
So follow and listen to Office Ladies on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
folks. Stay with us. Welcome back, folks. We're joined by DJ Johnson, founder and owner of Baldwin and Company in New Orleans. It's a bookstore that's actually located at 1030 Elysian Fields, and it's a coffee shop as well. And it has really become to be an intellectual hub for blacks in the city. And DJ's here to talk about an upcoming evening of discussion at Xavier University on November the 15th. With Ta-Nehisi Coates and Joy Ann Reed, the event has the potential to impact the community, and they hope to bring about discussions on tough issues that we're facing in this country and around the world. DJ, welcome to the show.
Man, thanks for having me. I appreciate it. It's an honor and it's a pleasure.
So, DJ, your bookstore coffee shop actually has been featured by Condé Nast and has been talked about in the New York Times. I was reading the backstory on you and the coffee shop, and very interesting as to how you came to be and what this is actually has become years later. Tell us about it.
Oh, man, thanks, man. It's been an honor and a pleasure. The city of New Orleans has just made Baldwin & Company just a global icon. And people in Japan and all over the country, in Europe, in China, that now know about Baldwin & Company. And so much of that is because of the people here in New Orleans that we've been able to become this literary hub of excellence that has inspired and will continue to inspire future generation of writers, thinkers, and leaders. And my journey back was a journey back to take care of my ailing mother. My mother, she fell sick. I was working a corporate job and living in Atlanta and Washington, D.C. And my mom got sick, and I decided to quit my corporate job and move back here to take care of my mom full time. And as she got better, I got bored. And I started really taking the time to look around the city and see where there was a void, where there was a gap, and where I can fill that void and that gap. And one of the things for me was literacy. I've always been an avid reader, and literacy is that key to unlocking the doors of progression, sustainability, opportunity. So for me, I wanted to make sure that I was blazing a path in establishing an institution that could be a beacon of hope and light for people in the city. Because one of the things that we know from statistics is that one of the biggest challenges facing our city is poverty, crime, lack of opportunity. Well, higher literacy rates has been proven to improve community standards, reduce crime, increase property values, elevate academic achievement. So the investment in literacy is a contribution to a new generation of a more literate, informed, and empowered New Orleans.
And, you know, what's interesting is we talk about this a lot. It seems very simplistic, but for whatever reason, in the overall dialogue in this country, it gets real complicated, and it's always mystified me. Your reaction?
On which part has mystified you, so I can better address it?
I mean, as you just pointed out, this literacy thing. I mean, literacy, I think, is the key to all kinds of things, you know, and it just seems as our approach in education, we're constantly fighting back and forth across the aisle, so to speak, about what, you know, which is the best course of action. And it just, you know, when you just describe it, it just seems simple, but it just becomes very complicated, right? I mean,
it is. When you think about it, like, so the World Literacy Organization says that As a society, we spend $1.7 trillion on illiteracy. That's how expensive it is to not be able to read, because it puts undue pressure on our healthcare system, pressure on our educational system, pressure on our criminal justice system. So the cost of illiteracy is $1.7 trillion annually. And when you think about it, it's like, man, you know what? If we want to alleviate issues that are plaguing us as a society, all we got to do is get people to read. I even teach people to read, because these individuals can't even read. So currently, right now, 84% of Louisiana students read below grade level. The problem with that,
there
it
is.
84% of that 84% that read below grade level, 79% of those individuals will end up incarcerated or on welfare.
So when we think about the criminal system, when we think about crime, when we think about healthcare, when we think about spending and support on government programs, you say, man, this can all be alleviated if we just simply teach people how to read because it improves their opportunity. So it does seem simple. I think there's so many other issues that plague individuals in the day-to-day activities that we forget that reading, just simply teaching our kids how to read, is the source of these issues because we're so busy tackling the weeds at the top rather than going to the source of the soil.
I love the way you put that. Why are we afraid to modify our approach? It would seem to me that in pre-K, whatever, nursery school, whatever we're doing in public education up until the first grade or second grade, it would seem to me that all we should do is read and journal, right? Read and write. All of those other subjects that we're taught, that can come later. It's a lot easier as you mature, right, to learn how to spell and all those other things. I don't understand why we are afraid of just reading and writing in the first years of our educational process. Your thoughts?
I agree. I am not well-versed enough in the curriculum and the education of the school system to critique it in terms of why that seems so difficult. To me, of course, I am very, very passionate about reading, so I think that it should be the number one priority as well. I mean, when they can read well, then they gain access to knowledge across subjects, empowering them to understand complex concepts in areas like science, history, and mathematics. So if you can't read well, then you're no longer going to be able to understand complex concepts inside science and history and mathematics. So I agree, it should be the number one priority. Why it's not? You know what? We would have to talk to some of the individuals who are making these decisions on studying the school curriculum and criteria. I remember, I went to a high school. I visited a high school 2 weeks ago, and I met with the principal, and he was asking for my support and how I can help. And I said, well, yeah, I don't know what I can do to help, but you want to get students to read better? I specialize in literacy. Let's put our heads together. So I started asking some questions. I said, what's your average ACT score? He said, 15. I said, oof, 15 is pretty low. 15 is very, very low. I said, okay. I said, well, what percent of your kids are reading below grade level? He said, 90%. This is a high school here. He said 90% of his kids are reading below grade level. And he said, well, I'm at a disadvantage because by the time they get to me, if they don't know how to read, we don't have any curriculum. We don't have any classes that teach individuals phonics and how to read. So if you get to the high school level and you don't know how to read, then at this point, there is no high school. And this is pretty much across the country. There's not any high school across the country that's teaching you how to read in high school. So what happens is the kids, they just get farther and farther behind, and they're never able to really develop critical thinking skills, comprehension, analytical skills that help children understand and question the world around them. So early reading instruction, it enhances memory, attention, and other cognitive abilities crucial for learning. And when we don't give kids that, then we take opportunities for economic growth, social emotional growth, equity and opportunity. We rob them of all that. So for me and you, I think it's easy to say that, hey, we have to prioritize reading in our school system, whether it's at pre-K through 4, as well as 4 through 8 and 9 through 12. It needs to be a part of every school curriculum, making sure that we are teaching people how to read and write. Why that exists, I don't know. Why it doesn't exist, I don't know, but I know at Baldwin & Company, we're going to do everything we can to help eradicate that functional literacy and a literacy that exists within New Orleans, within Louisiana, and hopefully scale it across the entire country.
So, DJ, let's talk about this evening of discussion at Xavier University on November 15th, Ta-Nehisi Coates and Joanne Reed. Two very well-known individuals, as some would say controversial, some not so much. talking about how we can better have these discussions on tough issues like you and I were just talking about that are facing the country and around the world. What would people experience by attending this event?
I mean, I love the word that you use, facing this country, because it makes me think about a quote by James Baldwin. He said, not everything that is faced can be changed, but nothing can be changed that isn't faced. So I think what people are going to gain from this is the ability, the knowledge, the insight on how to have constructive discourse across divides. Because we understand that it's not natural, it's not comfortable, it's not something that we practice on a daily basis, which hurts us in our ability to have tough conversations, to be able to progress us as a society. We confront an urgent reality right now, and we are at a point in American society where we must acknowledge psychological truths about confirmation bias, especially related to emotionally charged issues. Mm-hmm. Where we are in the current zeitgeist of the moment is a very intense time of polarization and division. The only way we're going to get through this is through dialogue. And this, it begins with a conscious, concerted effort to improve our discourse on difficult issues of nationalism, classism, identity, sexism, and racism. So James Baldwin has another quote. He says, people are trapped in history, and history is trapped in them. But we have to have these discussions to move us to a better future. And this conversation between two of the leading voices on history and race and just public dialogue and intellectual thought, these are two of the most prominent thought leaders that exist in the world, Ta-Nehisi Coates and Joy and Reed. This dialogue between them is not just going to inspire you, but it's going to delve into power dynamics on the human spirit's quest for freedom, making it especially relevant to the country's ongoing quest for justice and renewal, helping individuals understand how to go through the stages of comfort to discomfort to growth. And that's essentially where we want to be.
We can't get there, though, with the mindset that this is a zero-sum game, right?
Exactly.
Unfortunately, that's where we've ended up in so many different respects. And, you know, again, it's hard to move forward. I was talking about the reaction to the most recent election, both on the right and the left, and it's like, what are we doing? I mean, that this is how a democracy works. You win some, you lose some from an ideological perspective, but it's not a zero-sum game. You know, life as we know it is not coming to an end. It hasn't in the history of our democracy, and it will not, because as much as we don't want to admit it, we have matured in a lot of different ways. Is there always going to be a bias in society? There's a bias in societies that have existed thousands of years longer than ours. And, you know, so it's something that we have to face and we have to deal with as a challenge in our country, right?
Yeah, I agree. And I agree. It's not a zero-sum game. Unfortunately, a lot of people think about it as being a zero-sum game, but, you know, it's like, it's not pie. You know,
no.
You know, it's, yeah. It's not I take a piece and you get less. You know, we all can enjoy equality and justice and liberty for all. So I agree with you on that. And yeah, we're gonna have tough times, but I mean, it begins with us having constructive dialogue, and we got to remember that
absolutely
all such conversations, they're an exercise in human dignity with the goal of meaningful and sustainable progress. It's not guilt driven acquiesce or abandoning identity. Because neither of those lead to meaningful improvement. So one of the things that we want to do is we want to make sure that we're having a conversation on empathy and making sure that we're able to hear echoes of another person inside of ourselves. And I think that
absolutely
helps move forward in being disagree without being disagreeable.
Right. Thank you for joining us today. I'm sorry we're up against the clock. DJ Johnson, founder and owner of Baldwin & Company, the discussion at Xavier University on November 15th. I think that you can go to the Xavier website in order to find out more information, if my memory serves me correct. Thank you so much for joining us. Oh, the Baldwin & Company website. I'm sorry.
Yeah, Baldwin & Company.
Which is?
Go to the Baldwin & Company website. It's Baldwin
what is the website?
Books.com. It's www.baldwinandcobooks.com.
Thank you, sir. Truly appreciate you joining us today. We will be right back. Stay with us. Folks, when we come back after the top of the hour news break, we're going to visit with Guy Williams. We're going to talk about the Fed cutting rates, mortgage rates increase, and the German government, I don't know if you've been following this, is really on a state of collapse, and why that matters to us here in the U.S. So many different moving parts going on at the present time. We'll talk about that and more with Guy Williams. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
I'm Jenna Fisher.
And I'm Angela Kinsey.
And together we have the podcast Office Ladies.
Just because we finished rewatching The Office does not mean we're going anywhere.
Every Wednesday, we'll be sharing even more exclusive stories from The Office and our friendship with brand new guests. Plus, you can revisit all the Office Ladies rewatch episodes every Monday with new bonus tidbits before every episode.
So follow and listen to Office Ladies on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.